necrosis factor, to give one example, is a cytokine that gets its name from its ability to kill cancer cells. Tumors exposed to TNF in the laboratory simply melt away. It also helps raise body temperature and stimulates antibody production. But TNF is extraordinarily lethal, and not just to diseased cells. It can destroy healthy ones as well. In fact, it can kill the entire body. TNF is a toxin and a major cause of toxic shock syndrome, and it is not the only toxic cytokine. Routinely, the body fights off the influenza virus before it gains a solid foothold in the lungs themselves. But in 1918, the virus often succeeded in infecting epithelial cells not only in the upper respiratory tract, but all the way down the respiratory tract into the innermost sanctuaries of the lungs, into the epithelial cells of the alveoli. This was viral pneumonia. The immune system followed the virus into the lungs and there waged war. In this war, the immune system held nothing back. It used all its weapons, and it killed. It killed particularly with killer T cells, a white blood cell that targets the body's own cells when they are infected with a virus, and it killed with what is sometimes referred to as a cytokine storm, a massive attack using every lethal weapon the body possesses. The same capillaries that moved blood past the alveoli delivered this attack. The capillaries dilated, pouring out fluid, every kind of white blood cell, antibodies, other elements of the immune system, and cytokines into the lung. Then these cytokines and other enzymes virtually obliterated the capillaries. Even more fluid poured into the lung. The cells that line the alveoli were damaged, if they survived the virus itself. Pink, glassy membranes, called hyaline membranes, formed on the insides of the alveoli. Once these membranes formed, surfactant, a slippery, soap-like protein that reduces surface tension and eases the transfer of oxygen into red blood cells, disappeared from the alveoli. More blood flooded the lungs. The body started producing fiber-like connective tissue. Areas of the lung became enmeshed in cell debris, fibrin, collagen, and other materials. Proteins and fluid filled the space between cells. McFarlane Burnett, the Nobel laureate, described what was happening inside the lungs. Acute inflammatory injection. Very rapid necrosis of most of the epithelial lining of the bronchial tree down to and especially involving the smallest bronchioles. Essentially toxic damage to alveolar walls and exudation of blood and fluid. Continued exudation of fluid in areas where blocking of smaller bronchi had occurred would produce eventually airless regions. The immune system changes with age. Young adults have the strongest immune system in the population, most capable of mounting a massive immune response. Normally that makes them the healthiest element of the population. Under certain conditions, however, that very strength becomes a weakness. In 1918, the immune systems of young adults mounted massive responses to the virus. That immune response filled the lungs with fluid and debris, making it impossible for the exchange of oxygen to take place. The immune response killed. The influenza outbreak in 1997 in Hong Kong, when a new virus jumped from chickens to humans, killed only 6 people and it did not adapt to man. More than 1 million chickens were slaughtered to prevent that from happening, and the outbreak has been much studied. In autopsies, pathologists noticed extremely high cytokine levels, discovered even that the bone marrow, lymphoid tissue, spleen, all involved in the immune response, and other organs were themselves under attack from an immune system turned renegade. They believed that this proved syndrome was not previously described with influenza. In fact, investigators in 1918 had seen the same thing. This was still influenza. Only influenza. In the 1970s, physicians began to recognize a pathological process in the lungs that could have many causes, but once the process began, looked the same and received the same treatment. They called it ARDS, which stands for Acute Respiratory Distress Syndrome. Almost anything that puts extreme stress on the lung can cause ARDS. Near drowning, smoke inhalation, inhaling toxic fumes or poison gas, or influenzal viral pneumonia. Doctors today looking at pathology reports of lungs in 1918 would immediately designate the condition as ARDS. One pulmonary expert describes ARDS as a burn inside the lungs. It is a virtual scorching of lung tissue. When viral pneumonia causes the condition, the immune system toxins designed to destroy invaders are what, in effect, flame in the lung, scorching the tissue. Whatever the causes of ARDS, even today there is no way of stopping the process of disintegration in the lung once it begins. The only care is supportive, keeping the victim alive until he or she can recover. This requires all the technology of modern intensive care units. Still, even with the best modern care, even with, for example, dramatically more efficient and effective administration of oxygen than in 1918, the mortality rate for ARDS patients in different studies ranges from 40% to 60%. Without intensive care, and hospitals have few beds in intensive care units, the mortality rate would approach 100%. In 2003, a new coronavirus that causes SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome, appeared in China and quickly spread around the world. Coronaviruses cause an estimated 15 to 30% of all colds and, like the influenza virus, infect epithelial cells. When the coronavirus that causes SARS does kill, it often kills through ARDS, although since the virus replicates much more slowly than influenza, death from ARDS can come several weeks after the first symptoms. In ARDS, death can come from many causes. Organs outside the lungs fail because they get too little oxygen. The lungs can so fill with fluid that the right ventricle of the heart cannot empty it, so the victim drowns. The strain of trying to pump blood out of the lung can cause heart failure. Or the victim can simply die from exhaustion. He or she must breathe so rapidly to get enough oxygen that muscles become exhausted. Breathing just stops. ARDS by no means accounts for all the influenza deaths in 1918 and 1919, or even for a majority of them. It explains only those who died in a few days, and it explains why so many young, healthy people died. Although influenza almost certainly killed some people in ways that had little to do with the lungs, for example, someone whose already weak heart could not stand the additional strain of fighting the disease, the overwhelming majority of non-ARDS deaths came from bacterial pneumonias. The destruction of the epithelial cells eliminated the sweeping action that clears so much of the respiratory tract of bacteria, and the virus damaged or exhausted other parts of the immune system as well. That gave the normal bacteria flora of the mouth unimpeded entry into the lungs. Recent research also suggests that the neuraminidase on the influenza virus makes it easier for some bacteria to attach to lung tissue, creating a lethal synergy between the virus and these bacteria. And in the lungs, the bacteria began to grow. Bacterial pneumonias developed a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks after someone came down with influenza, including even a seemingly mild case of influenza. Often influenza victims seemed to recover, even returned to work, then suddenly collapsed again with bacterial pneumonia. It is impossible to know what percentage of the dead were killed by a viral pneumonia and ARDS, and how many died from bacterial pneumonias. Generally speaking, epidemiologists and historians who have written about this pandemic have assumed that the overwhelming majority of deaths came from secondary invaders, from bacterial pneumonias that can be fought with antibiotics. The conclusion of the Army's Pneumonia Commission, however, is chilling in terms of implications for today. This commission, comprised of half a dozen of the finest scientists in America, both conducted autopsies and reviewed pathology reports of others. It found signs of what would today be called ARDS in almost half the autopsies. A separate study limited to the pathology of the disease, conducted by Milton Winternitz, a Welch protege and later dean of the Yale Medical School, reached the same conclusion. That overstates the proportion of victims who died from ARDS, in effect from influenza viral pneumonia, because the Army study looked only at deaths among soldiers, men who were young and otherwise healthy, the group most likely to have been killed by their own immune systems. In the total population, viral pneumonias and ARDS would not account for as high a percentage of the deaths. Most deaths almost certainly did come from secondary bacterial infections, but probably not quite so many as has been assumed. That should, however, be small comfort for those who worry about the next influenza pandemic. The 1957 pandemic was far milder than 1918, but even then, 25% of the fatalities had viral pneumonia only. Three-quarters of the deaths came from complications, generally bacterial pneumonia, even in that golden age of antibiotics. Since then, bacterial resistance has become a major problem in medicine. Today, the mortality rate for a bacterial pneumonia following influenza is still roughly 7%, and in some parts of the United States, 35% of pneumococcal infections are resistant to the antibiotic of choice. When Staphylococcus aureus, a bacterium that has become particularly troubling in hospitals because of its resistance to antibiotics, is the secondary invader, the death rate, today, rises to as high as 42%. That is higher than the general death rate from bacterial pneumonias in 1918. Part 7. The Race. Chapter 22. Nature chose to rage in 1918, and it chose the form of the influenza virus in which to do it. This meant that nature first crept upon the world in familiar, almost comic form. It came in masquerade. Then it pulled down its mask and showed its fleshless bone. Then, as the pathogen spread from cantonments to cities, as it spread within cities, as it moved from city to town to village to farmhouse, medical science began moving as well. It began its own race against the pathogen, moving more rapidly and with more purpose than it ever had. Scientists did not presume to think that they would or could control this rage of nature. But they did not abandon their search for ways to control the damage of this rage. They still tried to save lives. Worldwide, their struggle, their race, commenced. In the United States, that struggle would be fought by Welch, Gorgas, Cole, and their colleagues, as well as by the institutions they had built and the men and women they had trained. Neither these institutions nor these men and women had ever been tested like this. They had never imagined they would be tested like this. But any possibility of affecting the course of the disease lay in their hands. To save lives, they needed the answer to at least one of three questions. It was possible that even a single rough approximation of an answer would give them enough knowledge to intervene, to interrupt the disease at some critical juncture. But it was also possible they could learn detailed answers to all three questions and still remain helpless, utterly helpless. First, they needed to understand the epidemiology of influenza, how it behaved and spread. Scientists had already learned to control cholera, typhoid, yellow fever, malaria, bubonic plague, and other diseases by understanding their epidemiology even before developing either a vaccine or cure. Second, they needed to learn its pathology, what it did within the body, the precise course of the disease. That, too, might allow them to intervene in some way that saved lives. Third, they needed to know what the pathogen was, what microorganism caused influenza. This could allow them to find a way to stimulate the immune system to prevent or cure the disease. It was also conceivable that even without knowing the precise cause, they could develop a serum or vaccine. The easiest question to answer for influenza was its epidemiology. Although some respected investigators still believed in the miasma theory, they thought influenza spread too fast for person-to-person contact to account for it, most believed correctly it was an airborne pathogen. Breathing it in could cause the disease. They did not know the exact, precise details that, for example, when the virus floats in the air, it can infect someone else for anywhere from an hour to a day after it is exhaled. The lower the humidity, the longer the virus survives. But they did know that it was a crowd disease, spread most easily in crowds. They also had an accurate estimate that someone with influenza sheds the virus, can infect others, usually from the third to the sixth day after he or she is infected. They also believed, correctly, that people could catch influenza not only by inhaling it, but by hand-to-mouth or nose contact. They rightly thought, for instance, that a sick person could cover his mouth with his hand when he coughed, then several hours later shake hands, and the second person could then rub his chin in thought or touch his nose or stick a piece of candy in his mouth and infect himself. Similarly, someone sick could cough into a hand, touch a hard surface, such as a doorknob, and spread it to someone else who turns the doorknob and later brings a hand to face. In fact, the virus can remain infectious on a hard surface for up to 2 days. Knowledge of influenza's epidemiology, then, was of little use. Only ruthless isolation and quarantine could affect its course. No scientist and no public health official had the political power to take such action. Some local authorities might take some action, but no national figure could. Even within the army, Gorgas's urgent and desperate calls to end the transfer of troops were ignored. Scientists were also learning too well about the pathology of the disease and its natural course. They were learning chiefly that they could do almost nothing to intervene in serious cases, in the cases that progressed to viral pneumonia and ARDS. Even administering oxygen seemed to have no effect. They believed they could, however, possibly save lives if they could prevent or treat the slower-moving pneumonias caused by what they were fairly quickly suspecting to be secondary invaders. Some preventive measures involved only giving proper guidance, such as to rest in bed after influenza infection, or giving good care, which was becoming more and more impossible as the numbers of the sick rose, as nurses and doctors themselves succumbed. But if they could find the pathogen, they had tools. They could manipulate the immune system. They could prevent and cure some pneumonias, including the most common pneumonias. The conquest of bacterial pneumonias seemed tantalizingly within the reach of science, tantalizingly at the very edge of scientists' reach, or just beyond it. If they could just find the pathogen. All the energies of science rose to that challenge. William Welch himself would not rise to it. From Camp Devens, he had returned directly to Baltimore, neither stopping in New York City nor going on to report to the Surgeon General's office in Washington. Others could perform that duty, and on the phone he had said what he had to say. In the meantime, Welch wasn't feeling very well. No doubt, he tried to shrug off the discomfort. He had, after all, had an exceedingly difficult trip. Just before going to Devens, he, Cole, and Vaughn had concluded their latest round of camp inspections and had just begun to relax for a few days in Asheville, North Carolina. He had even contemplated resigning his commission. Then they had been abruptly ordered to the Surgeon General's office on a Sunday, gone straight on to Devens, and there discovered this terrible disease. So he had every reason to be tired and out of sorts. Likely, he told himself something akin to that. The rattling of the train would have disturbed him, exacerbating the first signs of a headache. Large a man as he was, he had difficulty getting comfortable on a train anyway. But as the train moved south, he felt worse and worse, perhaps suffering a sudden violent headache and an unproductive cough, cough in which nothing came up, and certainly with a fever. He would have looked at himself clinically, objectively, and made a correct diagnosis. He had influenza. No record exists of his precise clinical course. All of Baltimore, all of the East Coast was erupting in flames. The virus struck the Hopkins itself so hard that the university closed its hospital to all but its own staff and students. Three Hopkins medical students, three Hopkins nurses, and three Hopkins doctors would die. Welch did not go to the hospital. Almost 70 years old, 40 years older than those who were dying in the greatest numbers, having just left the horror at Devon's and knowing the enormous strain on and therefore the likely poor care even at the Hopkins facility, he later said, "I could not have dreamed of going to a hospital at that time." Instead, he went to bed immediately in his own rooms and stayed there. He knew better than to push himself now. Pushing oneself after infection with this disease could easily open the path for a secondary invader to kill. After 10 days in bed at home, when he felt well enough to travel at all, to recuperate more, he withdrew entirely to his beloved Hotel Dennis in Atlantic City, the odd, tacky place that was his haven. In the midst of the chaos that was everywhere, he returned to this familiar place that gave him comfort. What had he always liked about it? Perhaps the life that roared through it. Quiet resorts bored him. He described Mohonk, a mountain resort 90 miles above New York City, as a kind of Twin Lakes resort with Miss Dares sitting in rockers on the broad piazza, where it seems as if 9 o'clock will never come so that one could go decently to bed. Colored neckties are not allowed. But Atlantic City, and the most terrifying, miraculous, blood-curdling affair called the Flip-Flap Railroad, just built on a long pier out over the ocean. You go down from a height of about 75 feet, with the head down and the feet up, so that you would drop out of the car if it was not for the tremendous speed. As you go round the circle, the effect is indescribable. Crowds stand around and say they would not try it for $1,000. Yes, the life that roared through Atlantic City, the young men and women and their frolicking, the sensuality of sweat and surf and salt, the vibrancy and thrust of flesh about the ocean and boardwalk, all that made one feel as if one were not merely observing but partaking. But now Atlantic City was quiet. It was October, off-season, the resorts quiet. And here, as everywhere, was influenza. Here, as everywhere, there was a shortage of doctors, a shortage of nurses, a shortage of hospitals, a shortage of coffins. Its schools closed, its places of public amusement closed, its Flip-Flap Railroad closed. He stayed in bed for several more weeks, recuperating. The disease, he told his nephew, seems to have localized itself in my intestinal rather than the respiratory tract, which is probably fortunate. He also insisted that his nephew, later a U.S. senator, make certain if any symptoms of influenza appeared at all in his family that the victim stay in bed until the temperature has been normal for 3 days. He had planned to attend a meeting on the disease at the Rockefeller Institute, but almost 2 weeks after arriving in Atlantic City, a month after first becoming ill, he canceled. He had not recovered enough to attend. He would play no further role in medical science for the course of the epidemic. He would not participate in the search for a solution. He had, of course, done no laboratory work in years, but he had often proved an extraordinarily useful conduit, knowing everyone and everything, a cross-pollinator recognizing how the work of one investigator might complement the work of another, and directly or indirectly putting the two in touch. Now, he would not play even that role. Coincidentally, both Flexner and Gorgas arrived in Europe on unrelated business, just as influenza erupted in America. The generation who had transformed American medicine had withdrawn from the race. If anything was to be done in the nature of a scientific breakthrough, their spiritual descendants would do the doing. Welch had left Massachusetts with Bert Volbach performing more autopsies, Milton Rosenau already beginning experiments on human volunteers, and Oswald Avery beginning bacteriological investigations. Other outstanding scientists had also already engaged this problem. William Park and Anna Williams in New York, Paul Lewis in Philadelphia, Preston Kies in Chicago, and others. If the country was lucky, very lucky indeed, one of them might find something soon enough to help. For all the urgency, investigators could not allow themselves to be panicked into a disorderly approach. Disorder would lead nowhere. They began with what they knew and with what they could do. They could kill pathogens outside the body. An assortment of chemicals could disinfect a room or clothes, and they knew precisely the amount of chemicals needed and the duration of exposure necessary to fumigate a room. They knew how to disinfect instruments and materials. They knew how to grow bacteria and how to stain bacteria to make them visible under microscopes. They knew that what Ehrlich called magic bullets existed that could kill infectious pathogens, and they even had started down the right pathways to find them. Yet in the midst of crisis, with death everywhere, none of that knowledge was useful. Fumigation and disinfecting required too much labor to work on a mass scale, and finding a magic bullet required discovering more unknowns than was then possible. Investigators quickly recognized they would get no help from Materia Medica. Medicine had, however, if not entirely mastered, at least knew how to use one tool, the immune system itself. Investigators understood the basic principles of the immune system. They knew how to manipulate those principles to prevent and cure some diseases. They knew how to grow and weaken or strengthen bacteria in the laboratory, and how to stimulate an immune response in an animal. They knew how to make vaccines, and they knew how to make antiserum. They also understood the specificity of the immune system. Vaccines and antisera work only against the specific etiological agent, the specific pathogen or toxin causing the disease. Few investigators cared how elegant their experiments were as friends, families, and colleagues fell ill. But to have the best hope of protecting with a vaccine or curing with a serum, investigators needed to isolate the pathogen. They needed to answer a first question, the most important question. Indeed, at this point, the only question. What caused the disease? Richard Pfeiffer believed he had found the answer to that question a quarter century earlier. One of Koch's most brilliant disciples, scientific director of the Institute for Infectious Disease in Berlin, and a general in the German army, he was 60 years old in 1918, and by then had become somewhat imperious. Over his career, he had addressed some of the great questions of medicine, and he had made enormous contributions. By any standard, he was a giant. During and after the 1889-90 influenza pandemic, with the exception of 1918-19, the most severe influenza pandemic in the last three centuries, he had searched for the cause. Carefully, painstakingly, he had isolated tiny, slender, rod-shaped bacteria with rounded ends, although they sometimes appeared in somewhat different forms, from people suffering from influenza. He often found the bacteria the sole organism present, and he found it in astonishing numbers. This bacteria clearly had the ability to kill, although in animals the disease produced did not quite resemble human influenza. Thus, the evidence against it did not fulfill Koch's postulates. But human pathogens often either do not sicken animals or cause different symptoms in them, and many pathogens are accepted as the cause of a disease without fully satisfying Koch's postulates. Pfeiffer was confident that he had found the cause of influenza. He even named the bacteria Bacillus influenzae. Today, this bacteria is called Haemophilus influenzae. Among scientists, the bacteria quickly became known as Pfeiffer's bacillus, and given his deserved reputation, few doubted the validity of his discovery. Certainty creates strength. Certainty gives one something upon which to lean. Uncertainty creates weakness. Uncertainty makes one tentative, if not fearful, and tentative steps, even when in the right direction, may not overcome significant obstacles. To be a scientist requires not only intelligence and curiosity, but passion, patience, creativity, self-sufficiency, and courage. It is not the courage to venture into the unknown. It is the courage to accept, indeed, embrace uncertainty. For as Claude Bernard, the great French physiologist of the 19th century, said, "Science teaches us to doubt." A scientist must accept the fact that all his or her work, even beliefs, may break apart upon the sharp edge of a single laboratory finding. And just as Einstein refused to accept his own theory until his predictions were tested, one must seek out such findings. Ultimately, a scientist has nothing to believe in but the process of inquiry. To move forcefully and aggressively, even while uncertain, requires a confidence and strength deeper than physical courage. All real scientists exist on the frontier. Even the least ambitious among them deal with the unknown, if only one step beyond the known. The best among them move deep into a wilderness region where they know almost nothing, where the very tools and techniques needed to clear the wilderness, to bring order to it, do not exist. There they probe in a disciplined way. There a single step can take them through the looking glass into a world that seems entirely different, and if they are at least partly correct, their probing acts like a crystal to precipitate an order out of chaos, to create form, structure, and direction. A single step can also take one off a cliff. In the wilderness, the scientist must create everything. It is grunt work, tedious work that begins with figuring out what tools one needs and then making them. A shovel can dig up dirt but cannot penetrate rock. Would a pick then be best, or would dynamite be better? Or would dynamite be too indiscriminately destructive? If the rock is impenetrable, if dynamite would destroy what one is looking for, is there another way of getting information about what the rock holds? There is a stream passing over the rock. Would analyzing the water after it passes over the rock reveal anything useful? How would one analyze it? Ultimately, if the researcher succeeds, a flood of colleagues will pave roads over the path laid, and those roads will be orderly and straight, taking an investigator in minutes to a place the pioneer spent months or years looking for. And the perfect tool will be available for purchase, just as laboratory mice can now be ordered from supply houses. Not all scientific investigators can deal comfortably with uncertainty, and those who can may not be creative enough to understand and design the experiments that will illuminate a subject, to know both where and how to look. Others may lack the confidence to persist. Experiments do not simply work. Regardless of design and preparation, experiments, especially at the beginning, when one proceeds by intelligent guesswork, rarely yield the results desired. An investigator must make them work. The less known, the more one has to manipulate and even force experiments to yield an answer. Which raises another question. How does one know when one knows? In turn, this leads to more practical questions. How does one know when to continue to push an experiment? And how does one know when to abandon a clue as a false trail? No one interested in any truth will torture the data itself, ever. But a scientist can, and should, torture an experiment to get data, to get a result, especially when investigating a new area. A scientist can, and should, seek any way to answer a question. If using mice and guinea pigs and rabbits does not provide a satisfactory answer, then trying dogs, pigs, cats, monkeys. And if one experiment shows a hint of a result, the slightest bump on a flat line of information, then a scientist designs the next experiment to focus on that bump, to create conditions more likely to get more bumps until they become either consistent and meaningful or demonstrate that the initial bump was mere random variation without meaning. There are limits to such manipulation. Even under torture, nature will not lie, will not yield a consistent, reproducible result, unless it is true. But if tortured enough, nature will mislead. It will confess to something that is true only under special conditions, the conditions the investigator created in the laboratory. Its truth is then artificial, an experimental artifact. One key to science is that work be reproducible. Someone in another laboratory doing the same experiment will get the same result. The result then is reliable enough that someone else can build upon it. The most damning condemnation is to dismiss a finding as not reproducible. That can call into question not only ability, but on occasion, ethics. If a reproducible finding comes from torturing nature, however, it is not useful. To be useful, a result must not only be reproducible, it must be, perhaps one should call it, expandable. One must be able to enlarge it, explore it, learn more from it, use it as a foundation to build structures upon. These things become easy to discern in hindsight. But how does one know when to persist, when to continue to try to make an experiment work, when to make adjustments, and when finally to abandon a line of thought as mistaken or incapable of solution with present techniques? How does one know when to do either? The question is one of judgment. For the distinguishing element in science is not intelligence, but judgment. Or perhaps it is simply luck. George Sternberg did not pursue his discovery of the pneumococcus, and he did not pursue his discovery that white blood cells devoured bacteria. He did not because doing so would have deflected him from his unsuccessful pursuit of yellow fever. Given his abilities, had he focused on either of those other discoveries, his name would be well known instead of forgotten in the history of science. Judgment is so difficult because a negative result does not mean that a hypothesis is wrong. Nor do 10 negative results, nor do 100 negative results. Ehrlich believed that magic bullets existed. Chemical compounds could cure disease. His reasoning led him to try certain compounds against a certain infection. Ultimately, he tried more than 900 chemical compounds. Each experiment began with hope. Each was performed meticulously. Each failed. Finally, he found the compound that did work. The result was not only the first drug that could cure an infection, it confirmed a line of reasoning that led to thousands of investigators following the same path. How does one know when one knows? When one is on the edge, one cannot know. One can only test. Thomas Huxley advised, "Surely there is a time to submit to guidance and a time to take one's own way at all hazards." Thomas Rivers was one of the young men from the Hopkins on the Army's Pneumonia Commission. He would later, only a few years later, define the differences between viruses and bacteria, become one of the world's leading virologists, and succeed Cole as head of the Rockefeller Institute Hospital. He gave an example of the difficulty of knowing when one knows when he spoke of two Rockefeller colleagues, Albert Sabin and Peter Olitsky. As Rivers recalled, they proved poliovirus would grow only in nervous tissue. Elegant work. Absolutely convincing. Everyone believed it. Everyone believed it, that is, except John Enders. The virus Sabin and Olitsky were working with had been used in the laboratory so long that it had mutated. That particular virus would grow only in nervous tissue. Enders won a Nobel Prize for growing poliovirus in other tissue, work that led directly to a polio vaccine. Sabin's career was hardly ruined by his error. He went on to develop the best polio vaccine. Olitsky did well, too. But had Enders pursued his intuition and been wrong, much of his own career would have been utterly wasted. Richard Pfeiffer insisted he had discovered the cause, the etiological agent of influenza. His confidence was so great he had even named it Bacillus influenzae. He had tremendous stature, half a rung below Pasteur, Koch, and Ehrlich. Surely his reputation stood higher than that of any American investigator before the war. Who would challenge him? His reputation gave his finding tremendous weight. Around the world, many scientists believed it. Indeed, some accepted it as an axiom. Without the bacteria, there could be no influenza. "No influenza bacilli have been found in cases here," wrote one European investigator. Therefore, the disease was, he concluded, not influenza. Chapter 23. Laboratories everywhere had turned to influenza. Pasteur's protégé Émile Roux, one of those who had raced German competitors for a diphtheria antitoxin, directed the work at the Pasteur Institute. In Britain, virtually everyone in Almroth Wright's laboratory worked on it, including Alexander Fleming, whose later discovery of penicillin he first applied to research on Pfeiffer's so-called influenza bacillus. In Germany, in Italy, even in revolution-torn Russia, desperate investigators searched for an answer. But by the fall of 1918, these laboratories could function only on a far reduced scale. Research had been cut back and focused on war, on poison gas or defending against it, on preventing infection of wounds, on ways to prevent diseases that incapacitated troops such as trench fever, an infection related to typhus that was not serious in itself but had taken more troops out of the line than any other disease. Laboratory animals had become unavailable. Armies consumed them for testing poison gas and similar purposes. The war had also sucked into itself technicians and young researchers. Laboratories in both Europe and the United States were affected, but Europeans suffered far more, with their work limited by shortages not only of people, but of everything from coal for heat to money for petri dishes. At least those resources Americans had. And if the United States still lagged behind Europe in the number of investigators, it no longer lagged in the quality of investigators. The Rockefeller Institute had already become arguably the best research institute in the world. Out of a mere handful of scientists working there then, one man had already won the Nobel Prize and two would win it. In the most relevant area of work, in pneumonia, the Rockefeller Institute had a clear lead over the rest of the world, and Rockefeller scientists were hardly the only Americans doing world-class work. For Welch, Michigan's Victor Vaughn, Harvard's Charles Eliot, Penn's William Pepper, and the handful of colleagues who had pushed so hard for change had succeeded. They had transformed American medical science. If that transformation had only just occurred, if it had only recently risen to the level of Europe, it also had the vitality that comes from recent conversion. And the nation at large was not so exhausted as Europe. It was not exhausted at all. As influenza stretched its fingers across the country and began to crush out lives in its grip, virtually every serious medical scientist, and many simple physicians who considered themselves of scientific bent began looking for a cure. They were determined to prove that science could indeed perform miracles. Most of them, simply, were not good enough to address the problem with any hope of success. They tried anyway. Their attempt was heroic. It required not just scientific ability, but physical courage. They moved among the dead and dying, reached swabs into mouths and nasal passages of the desperately ill, steeped themselves in blood in the autopsy room, dug deep into bodies, and struggled to grow from swabbings, blood, and tissue the pathogen that was killing more humans than any other in history. A few of these investigators, possibly as few as a few dozen, were smart enough, creative enough, knowledgeable enough, skilled enough, and commanded enough resources that they were not on a fool's errand. They could confront this disease with at least the hope of success. In Boston, Rosenau and Keegan continued to study the disease in the laboratory. The bulk of the Army's pneumonia commission had been ordered to Camp Pike, Arkansas, where, even as Welch arrived at Devens, they began investigating a new bronchopneumonia. The Rockefeller team, whom Welch had brought to Devens, headed back to New York, where they added Martha Wallstein, a respected bacteriologist also associated with the Rockefeller Institute, to the effort. She had studied the influenza bacillus since 1905. In Chicago at the Memorial Institute for Infectious Diseases, Ludwig Hechten dove into the work. And at the Mayo Clinic, E.C. Rosenau did the same. The only civilian government research institution, the Public Health Services Hygienic Laboratory and its director, George McCoy, joined in. But of all those working on it in the United States, perhaps the most important were Oswald Avery at Rockefeller, William Park and Anna Williams at the New York City Department of Public Health, and Paul Lewis in Philadelphia. Each of them brought a different style to the problem, a different method of doing science. For Park and Williams, the work would come as close to routine as something could be in the midst of such extreme crisis. Their efforts would have no impact on their own lives in any personal sense, although they would help direct research on influenza down the path that ultimately yielded the right answer. For Avery, the work would confirm him in a direction that he would follow for decades. Decades first of enormous frustration, but then of momentous discovery. In fact, a discovery that opened the door to an entire universe even now just beginning to be explored. For Lewis, although he could not have known it, his work on influenza would mark a turning point in his own life, one that would lead to a great tragedy for science, for his family, and for himself. It was not a good time to confront a major new threat in the Bureau of Laboratories of the New York City Department of Public Health, the bureau Park ran and in which Williams worked. For they had a special problem, New York City politics. On January 1, 1918, Tammany Hall reclaimed control of the city. Patronage came first. Hermann Biggs, the pioneer who had built the department, had left a year earlier to become state health commissioner. Biggs had been untouchable because he had treated a top Tammany leader who had protected the entire department during prior Tammany administrations. His successor was not untouchable. Mayor John Hyland replaced him 2 weeks after taking control. But most jobs in the Department of Health were not patronage positions, so to create vacancies, Tammany began to smear the best municipal health department in the world. Soon, Hyland demanded the firing of division chiefs and the removal of highly respected physicians on the advisory board. Even the new Tammany-appointed health commissioner balked at that and resigned, leaving the department leaderless. The mayor was standing on the sidewalk outside City Hall when a crony introduced Royal Copeland to him, said he was a loyal Tammany man, and suggested the mayor name him the new health commissioner. But Copeland, dean of a homeopathic medical school, was not even an MD. Nonetheless, the mayor agreed to appoint him. The three men then climbed the steps to his office, and Copeland was sworn in. The best municipal public health department in the world was now run by a man with no belief in modern scientific medicine and whose ambitions were not in public health, but in politics. If Tammany wanted vacancies to fill with loyalists, that is what he would give them. Copeland once explained his loyalty to Tammany in simple terms. Man is a social animal and cannot work without cooperation. Organization is a necessity, and my organization is Tammany. A few years later, Tammany would repay his loyalty by carrying him to the United States Senate. So he continued the machine's efforts to disassemble the department. One of the best division heads was first threatened with criminal charges, and when that failed, he was hauled to a civil service hearing on charges of neglect of duty, inefficiency, and incompetency. Park had run the department's laboratory division since 1893, had never involved himself in politics, and was himself untouchable. He continued to do excellent science in the midst of this turmoil. Soon after, Avery and Cole and others at Rockefeller developed their serum against types 1 and 2 pneumococcus, Park developed a procedure for typing the pneumococcus so simple that any decent laboratory could perform it within 30 minutes, allowing nearly immediate use of the right serum for treatment. But now he had to defend the department. He helped organize a defense, and the defense became national. Criticism rained down on Tammany from the city, the state, from Baltimore, Boston, Washington. Welch and nearly every major figure in medicine attacked Tammany. Rupert Blue, the head of the U.S. Public Health Service, publicly called upon the mayor to desist. Tammany backed off, and Copeland embarked on a public relations campaign to repair the damage to himself and his organization, relying on patriotism to stifle criticism. By late summer, the frenzy had died down, but what had been the best public health department in the world was demoralized. The internationally respected director of the Bureau of Public Health Education resigned. The deputy commissioner of health, in office 20 years, resigned, and the mayor replaced him with his personal physician. On September 15th, New York City's first influenza death occurred. By then, the disease had long since begun leaking out of the Army and Navy bases into the civilian population of Massachusetts. In two polio epidemics in the preceding decade, public health officials had all but closed down the city. But now, Copeland did nothing. 3 days later, as hospitals began filling with influenza cases, he made influenza and pneumonia reportable diseases, while simultaneously stating that other bronchial diseases and not the so-called Spanish influenza are said to be responsible for the illness of the majority of persons who were reported to be ill with influenza. A few days more, and even Copeland could no longer deny reality. People could see disease all about them. Finally, he imposed a quarantine on victims and warned, "The health department is prepared to compel patients who may be a menace to the community to go to hospitals." He also assured all concerned that the disease is not getting away from the control of the health department, but is decreasing. Park knew better. As a student in Vienna in 1890, he had watched that influenza pandemic kill one of his professors and wrote, "We mourn for him and for ourselves." And for several months now, he and others in his laboratory had followed the progress of the disease. He was well aware of the transformation of the city of Exeter into a floating morgue and of serious cases in July and August on ships arriving in New York Harbor. Those cases did one good thing. They relieved the laboratory of political pressure and allowed him and it to concentrate on work. In late August, he and Anna Williams began devoting all their energies to the disease. In mid-September, they were called to Camp Upton in Long Island. The disease had just reached there, and few deaths had occurred. Yet. But already a single barracks, filled with soldiers from Massachusetts, had 2,000 cases. Park and Williams had collaborated now for a quarter of a century, and they complemented each other perfectly. He was a quiet, brown-eyed man with a somewhat reserved, even aristocratic bearing. He had a claim to the social elite. His father's ancestors arrived in America in 1630, his mother's in 1640. He also felt a calling. Three great aunts had been missionaries and were buried in Ceylon. A cousin to whom he was very close became a minister, and Park himself had considered becoming a medical missionary. He had a serious purpose, and curiosity per se did not drive that purpose. His seeking of knowledge in the laboratory served his purpose only to the extent, as he saw it, that it served God's purpose. He donated his salary as professor of bacteriology at New York University to the laboratory, or at least into the hands of some of his professional workers who struggled on city salaries. He also involved himself directly with patients, often working the diphtheria wards at the city-run Willard Parker Hospital across the street from his laboratory. The hospital was a new, gleaming place, 35 iron bedsteads to each ward, with water closets and bathtubs of marble with porcelain lining, the polished hardwood floors washed every morning with a 1-to-1,000 solution of bichloride of mercury, the same solution in which patients themselves bathed at discharge and admission. Methodical, somewhat stolid, he was a master bureaucrat in the best sense of the word. He had run the health department's Bureau of Laboratories for decades and had always looked for ways to make the system work. What drove him was the desire to bring laboratory research to patients. He was a pragmatist. Goethe observed that one searches where there is light. Some scientists try to create new light to shine on problems. Park was not one such. His forte was making exhaustive explorations with existing light. It was his and Williams's work that had led to mass production of inexpensive diphtheria antitoxin. It was his work that had marked America's acceptance as a scientific equal of Europe when that international conference had endorsed his views on tuberculosis over Koch's. His scientific papers were exact, if not quite elegant, and he matched his precision with a deeply probing and careful mind. It was that precision and the missionary's sense of right and wrong that had led to his public feud over meningitis serum a few years earlier with Simon Flexner and the Rockefeller Institute. In 1911, Park had created the Laboratory for Special Therapy and Investigation, at least in part to rival the Rockefeller Institute. He was a few years older now, but no mellower. He and Flexner remained pretty acid about each other, noted one scientist who knew them both well, with no love lost between them. But despite their animosity, both of them cooperated with the other whenever called upon, and neither held back information. This openness was a far cry from the atmosphere at some other laboratories, including the Pasteur Institute. Pasteur himself had once advised a protege not to share information with outsiders, saying, "Keep your cadavers to yourself." When Anna Williams visited there, she was refused any information on a pneumonia antiserum until it was published, and also had to promise that after she left, she would say nothing about anything else she had seen until it was published. Even in publication, Pasteur scientists did not tell everything. As Biggs wrote Park, "Marmarek has taught her how it's done. It is secret, of course." In the usual way, he omitted the essential thing in his article. If Park was almost stolid, Anna Williams injected a certain wildness and creativity into the laboratory. She loved going up in airplanes with stunt flyers, a reckless act in pre-World War I airplanes, and loved sudden fast turns and out-of-control drops. She loved to drive and was always speeding. When traffic was stalled, she often simply pulled into the opposite side of the road and proceeded, and she had a string of traffic tickets to prove it. Once she took a mechanics course and decided to take her Buick engine apart, but failed to put it back together. In her diary she wrote, "From my earliest memories, I was one of those who wanted to go places. When I couldn't go, I would have my dreams about going." And such wild dreams were seldom conceived by any other child. Despite or more likely because of her wildness, she had established herself as the premier woman medical scientist in America. Her achievement came at a price. She was unhappy. She was also lonely. At the age of 45, she wrote, "I was told today that it was quite pathetic that I had no one particular friend." She and Park had worked together for decades, but they maintained a careful distance. To her diary, she confided, "There are degrees to everything, including friendship. There is no sentimentality about my friendships, and little sentiment." Religion gave her no relief. She wanted too much from it. She told herself that Jesus knew that his anguish was momentary, and that in exchange he was going to save the world. This knowledge, if we were sure, oh, what would we not be willing to undergo? Of course, she had no such knowledge. She could only recall all the good things I have been taught, and act as if they were true. Yet in the end, although jealous of those who lived a normal life, she still preferred discontent rather than happiness through lack of knowledge. Instead, she did content herself with the fact that I have had thrills. Analyzing herself, she confided in her diary that what mattered to her more were love of knowledge, love of appreciation, love of winning, fear of ridicule, and power to do, to think new things. These were not Park's motives, but she and Park made a powerful combination. In science, at least, she had had thrills indeed. She was 55 years old in 1918. Park was the same age. There were no thoughts of thrills on the long drive and rough roads from Manhattan to Camp Upton, even though Park indulged her and let her drive. At the camp, the military doctors, no